how do they feel about these new oblasts of the eastern part of Ukraine? Do they really think that they are part of Russia? I'm talking about the public in Russia.
There's no doubt in their minds that they're part of Russia. There's no debate. There's no discussion. There's no dialogue. They are Russia, and Russia views them as Russia. This isn't a joke. This isn't a game. This isn't some sort of geopolitical cuteness. Russia went to war. Russia didn't want Zaporizhia. They didn't want Kherson. They may have wanted it, but they didn't desire to take it from Ukraine, but they were compelled to do so. And now that they have done so, these territories are part of Russia. I was in Kherson. I interviewed the governor. I interviewed the head of their economic development. They are rebuilding that place as this war goes on, so that it is a functional part of Russia. There's no debating this. In the West, we can sit there and play stupid games by drawing lines on maps saying we don't recognize that. Russia doesn't care. Drive into Kherson and ask them, are you Russian or are you Ukrainian? There's no debate, no discussion. They're Russian. They will always be Russian, forever in perpetuity.
How they're helping them right now, because they were so devastated, these regions were so devastated by this war.
Well, I mean, in Kherson, first investment project that was put in place was the construction of a concrete manufacturing plant, one line. They now have six lines. I think the plant was designed to produce concrete at a rate of 60 cubic meters per hour. You have six lines. That's six times six, 360 cubic meters of concrete per hour. I'm not a construction specialist, but that's a lot of concrete. And they're producing it and they're pouring it, which means they're building stuff. So I think I just answered your question.
They were part of Ukraine for years, and right now they're going to be part of Russia. How do you find these differences between these two? Is there anything different from what you've seen in Russia and what you've seen in the eastern part of Ukraine, culturally, traditionally?
Well, first of all, there is no such thing as the eastern part of Ukraine. Let's just correct the record. There's the new Russian territories. There is no eastern Ukraine. Doesn't exist. Finished. Now, I mean, there's people out there that'll, for political reasons, talk about it, but it doesn't exist. Physically, it doesn't exist. There is no eastern Ukraine. Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Lugansk are part of Russia forever. It will never change. So we shouldn't talk about eastern Ukraine. We can talk about the new territories. But let's understand this, that even there was never really a viable Ukraine to begin with. When we speak of Ukraine during the Soviet times, it wasn't an independent entity. It was part of the Soviet Union, which was in effect part of Greater Russia. Moscow was dictating outcomes. Kiev was a regional capital that received orders from Moscow. And everybody worked together towards the common good. You had, I mean, when you look at the leadership of the Soviet Union, Brezhnev was a Ukrainian. He ruled for 18 years. Khrushchev's wife was Ukrainian. He identified as Ukrainian. He ruled for 10 years. So for 28 years, the Soviet Union was ruled by Ukrainians. But they didn't say that. They were ruled by Soviets. The senior officers in the Russian and Ukrainian military today all trained together in the same academies. They didn't view themselves as Ukrainian or Russian. They viewed themselves as Soviet, which means part of Greater Russia. Everybody who lives in the Eastern territories, who speaks Russian, practices Russian Orthodox faith, never viewed themselves as Ukrainian. They always viewed themselves as Russia. And when the Soviet Union collapsed and Ukraine became an independent state, these people never said, oh, I'm with Kiev. They always said, no, I'm Russian. I'm with Moscow. That's just the reality of it. Now, they had to live with a political reality that, you know, they were part of Ukraine from a sovereign standpoint, but they continued to fight for their rights, struggle for the right to speak Russian. You know, everybody talks about the 2014 Maidan coup that took place, but the real coup when it comes to the split between what's Ukrainian and Russia was in 2005 during the Orange Revolution. That was the first nationalist coup d'etat, where the nationalists came in, who started to promote this Ukrainian national identity. The president at that time, elevated Stepan Bandera to a national hero. And they began to attack Russian speakers, Russian culture, etc. That's where you started to see the first divided, because prior to that, I just interviewed Nikolai Azarov, who was the former prime minister of Ukraine. He said prior to that, prior to the Velvet Revolution, there was no talk about Russians and Ukrainians. We lived together, we worked together, we worked towards a common goal, etc. It was only after the Velvet Revolution that we started to, you see the split. And when the Ukrainian nationalists, who were now empowered, started attacking the Russians, they compelled the Russians to start viewing themselves as Russian. And then, therefore, now there's a split with between them and Ukraine, and they started looking to Russia for help to defend them. At the same time that the Velvet Revolution took place, President Putin gave a speech in the Federal Assembly in 2005. It's a speech where he said that the greatest, one of the greatest, catastrophes of the last century was the fall, collapse of the Soviet Union. And everybody picked up on that speech saying, aha, he wants to return to Soviet times. No, if you know anything about Putin, anything about the Russians, no, they didn't want that. Because what he said next is what's important, because overnight, millions of Russians became homeless. And those homeless included the Russians of Ukraine. At the time he gave that speech, Russians were being attacked in Ukraine for the crime of being Russian. And he said, my job is the Russian president. The president is the president of the Russian nation. And the Russian nation is not defined by the borders of the Russian Federation. The Russian nation is defined by a people united in shared history, shared culture, shared language, shared religion, which means he was responsible for the well-being of these Russians, these ethnic Russians in Ukraine, in the Baltic states, and in Kazakhstan, elsewhere. He was responsible for their safety, for their protection. So the idea that this pro-Russian sentiment that's in the eastern Ukraine, it's not artificial. It's real. They've always viewed themselves as Russian, and to the extent that they've been separated from Ukraine, it's the Ukrainian government's fault. It wasn't Russia coming in trying to strip them away. In fact, if you take a look at the Minsk Accords in 2014, the Donbas, Donetsk, Lugansk, the separatists wanted to become part of Russia, and Putin said, no, you're part of Ukraine. So, from a sovereign standpoint, you're part of Ukraine. Prior to 2014, when the right sector made a grab to seize Crimea and seize the port facilities in Sevastopol, Russia viewed Crimea as part of Ukraine. They didn't like that. The Russians that lived there said, we're Russian. But from a legal standpoint, Russia was not making an effort to strip these territories away. They only took control of these territories when the Ukrainian nationalists started to threaten the security of the Russian people living there. Then the Russian president of the Russian nation said, it's my duty and responsibility to protect these people. Until the West understands that and respects that, then we'll never, we'll just never be able to be in sync with Russia. And the reality is that the Russian nation today includes Odessa, Nikolaev, Dnepropetrovsk, and Kharkov. And you could probably call that Eastern Ukraine today because that's the easternmost part, but it won't be Eastern Ukraine much longer. It will be part of the new Russian territories because this war, I don't believe, will end until those territories are incorporated into Russia as well.
I think the picture that you've just drawn for us totally describes why Russia calls it special military operation, because it's not anything like what we've seen in Gaza.
I know it's a meme because but it showed a photograph of Kiev today and compared it to a photograph of Gaza. And he said, this is Kiev at war. This is Gaza at war. Now, you can replace Gaza, Kiev with the photograph of Bakhmut, a photograph of Mariupol, a photograph of Avdiivka, and you'll see totally destroyed cities. So it's sort of a cute, too cute to be true. I mean, but the point is, Kiev is the capital of Ukraine, and it functions today as if there wasn't a war. Yes, every once in a while, electric power goes out. But, the notion that you can have a functioning parliament, that you can have a president unscathed, you can have foreign leaders hostile to Russia's interests traveling freely to Kiev and walking around and seeing things is absurd. If this was a war, Kiev would be flattened. And that's the reality. It is a special military operation. Russia is waging this conflict in a manner that is totally different from war, because Russia knows that one day this war will end and that it will have to deal with what's left. And it would rather deal with a Ukraine that could be rapidly reconstituted as a viable nation state with infrastructure that functioned, as opposed to a totally devastated nation that becomes a burden to Russia going forward.
Germany and Japan signed a military pact to contain China. What's the reason behind this, in your opinion?
I think it's primarily involved in the sharing of defense technology and things of that nature. Germany can't deploy troops. They can deploy a reinforced battalion to Lithuania. They're talking about expanding that to a brigade, but that's going to create a crisis within the German military in terms of sustainability. What German forces are going to go to the aid of Japan? None. Zero. What Japanese forces are going to come to the aid of Germany? None. Zero. It's a meaningless document. It's a political document. It's a document to make up for the fact that at the last NATO summit, France vetoed the notion of NATO setting up an office in Japan. So what Germany's doing is recognizing that while NATO can't be in Japan, that it will enter into relations so that it can be shown that NATO and Japan through the German action are cooperating with each other. But if Japan gets dragged into an American conflict with China over Taiwan, Germany will not be coming to the assistance of Japan.
When you look at these kind of actions together with the tensions that you're witnessing in Taiwan, the United States and United Kingdom were asking China to help them to talk with Iranians. When you look at all these equations, what's the logic behind this?
What I see is incompetence, and what I see is a Biden administration that's reacting to global events, not being proactive. We have a China policy. The policy deals with economically isolating or weakening China, and also strengthening our ties with Taiwan to facilitate eventual independence of Taiwan. Even though we claim that we support a one China policy, we don't. So we have these policies. We're confronted with certain realities, like we don't have sufficient force to recapture the 12 dash line or 9 dash line, the islands in the South Pacific. We're not able to sustain a military presence in the Straits of Taiwan. So we know what the reality is, but our policy is one of aggression. And we can't change that. So now we come in the situation with the Houthi, and we want the Chinese to do something for us and say, we'd like your help. And China's like, why would I do this? Chinese ships aren't being interdicted, just your ships. What's in it for me? Diplomacy is the art of the two-way street. It just seems absurd that that we somehow think China would come to our assistance, vis-à-vis the Houthi, while at the same time we continue policies designed to isolate, undermine, and defeat China. We need to get our act together and stop looking at defeating people, especially militarily, and start looking about competing with people economically and diplomatically. We might have more luck, because everything we're doing right now is a failure.
Talking about the Red Sea and what's going on, how did you find this operation so far? How successful was that in controlling Houthis?
It's a total failure, abject failure. The purpose is to establish deterrence so that the Houthi will be deterred from continuing their action. Well, they haven't been deterred. All it's done is expose the reality that the United States cannot keep open one of the strategic waterways of the world, the Bab el-Mandeb. And what's the lesson from this? The United States won't be able to keep the Strait of Hormuz open as well. So any expanded conflict drags in Iran, means that Iran will shut down the Strait of Hormuz, and we're helpless. We can't stop that. And now the global economy will be strangled. So I don't see a situation where what the United States is doing is benefited it in any way, shape, or form. Rather than bombing, we should have turned to diplomacy and the quickest way out of the predicament that we've created for ourselves isn't to bomb people into submission, but to engage about an equitable solution to the Palestinian problem, to bring an end to the fighting between Israel and Hamas. If you do that, the other problems tend to solve themselves. But if you're going to continue to go all in on the side of Israel, understand that there will be, consequences to pay, and we don't have the military force to effectively deter those consequences.
When it comes to dealing with Houthis, with all of these groups in the Middle East, they're talking about Iran. Iran is the core of these problems. Lindsey Graham and other Republican, basically Republican senators, were talking about bombing Iran. If they bomb Iran, they can solve the problems in the Middle East.
No, I mean, if by bombing Iran we could solve the problems in the Middle East, we would have bombed Iran a long time ago. The reason why we don't bomb Iran is that it won't solve the problems in the Middle East. It'll just make the problems even greater. Not only that, but there's no guarantee that we win any conflict with Iran. We know that Iran will be able to inflict near fatal economic damage on the United States and the world by shutting down the Strait of Hormuz, and if necessary, destroying the oil production infrastructure of the Persian Gulf, the non-Persian oil producing infrastructure. Donald Trump was given the option of bombing Iran back in, I think, 2020, when the Iranians shot down a Global Hawk drone over the Straits of Hormuz. But he was told by the Pentagon that if you do bomb Iran, then there could be escalation that leads to a major conflict, and the United States doesn't have sufficient military forces in the region to guarantee an outcome. And it would take months, if not years, to assemble that force, and even then, you couldn't guarantee an outcome. This is why Donald Trump didn't bomb Iran. We will not attack Iran today for the same reason, because we don't have forces sufficient enough to sustain an attack capable of deterring or preventing additional Iranian muscle flexing. If we were to bomb Iran, then Iran would shut down the Strait of Hormuz and attack all major American military facilities in the region, and there'd be nothing we could do to prevent that. And so it would expand into a broader conflict where we would be firing cruise missiles, dropping bombs. But Iran is not defenseless. There are protections. And then what happens? They shoot down a couple American airplanes. Now they have a couple American prisoners of war. We launch an amphibious attack on the Iranian coast. It gets defeated. We have thousands dead. I mean, this is the circle of violence that hopefully the people close to Joe Biden are advising him will occur, and therefore you shouldn't attack Iran, because we know what the outcome will be: a broader war that the United States can't win.
In your opinion, with what we've seen so far in Gaza, what was the outcome of this conflict for Netanyahu and his administration and his party in Israel?
Strategic defeat across the board. Understand that Netanyahu and his government are responsible, solely responsible, for what happened on October 7th, especially from an Israeli point of view. Not only were Israeli forces caught by surprise, but they were defeated by Hamas. And the Israeli response was one that slaughtered hundreds of Israeli citizens. Israel tried to blame it on Hamas, but I think it's clear today that the majority of the Israeli civilians who died on October 7th and 8th died at the hands of the Israeli Defense Force, who are implementing in one degree or another policies consistent with the Hannibal Directive to kill Israelis taken hostage before they can get back into Hamas-controlled territory or terrorist-controlled territory. So he's a failed leader, right, from there. He promised by engaging in an escalation of military might against Hamas in Gaza that he would, A, destroy Hamas's military capability to ensure that Hamas could never again carry out an attack that on the scope and scale of what was done on October 7th, and B, to destroy Hamas politically, so that Hamas would have no role in whatever the future political leadership of Palestine was. He's failed on both accounts. The Israeli military has been fought to a standstill in many cases, compelled to retreat from territory inside the Gaza Strip. The Israelis acknowledge that they've accounted for barely 20% of the tunnels in the Hamas tunnel network, and they haven't defeated the fighters themselves, who continue to resist and kill Israelis. So, you know, from a military standpoint, you know, Hamas continues to exist and continues, therefore, to have the capability of striking Israel on Israeli soil. So, Israel lost that fight. Politically, Hamas today is more powerful and popular than they have ever been. If there was an election held amongst the Palestinian people today, Hamas would win hands down. They would win the legislative body. They would win the presidency. Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, has all but admitted this. So, you know, where does that leave Netanyahu? He's dealing with a reality here. Hamas has become even stronger politically and militarily. They exist, and there's nothing Israel can do to diminish Hamas from a military standpoint. This is a strategic defeat for Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel.
But we've seen that they attacked a hospital in the West Bank. They said some terrorists were there. When it comes to the West Bank, is there any sort of sovereignty? How do they control this part of Palestine? I don't know if I can call it Palestine or Israel.
Well, I think the West Bank is part of Palestine. When you take a look at the Abraham Accords and the maps that are published in there, they talk about the Palestinian territory on the West Bank and Gaza Strip united into a nation state, even though it's extremely diminished territories that would be under the control of the Palestinian Authority. The Israelis are occupying an occupying power. You look at the United States, we finally have woken up, and in order to put pressure on Israel, we've talked about sanctioning the illegal settlement actions on the West Bank. Israel doesn't do itself any favors with how it treats the Palestinians there. The murder. It's not an anti-terrorist operation. It was murder. It's a violation of international law. The Israeli military personnel involved should be arrested and prosecuted as war criminals. They assassinated civilians in a hospital who, you know, posed no military threat. It doesn't matter that they were at one point in time affiliated with Hamas. They're not under arms. They're in a protected area, in a protected building, in a protected activity, and yet Israel came in and assassinated them in cold blood. This is a war crime of the most vile nature, and you know, under in a perfect world, you'd see the international community rallying against what the Israelis have done. But to be honest, today most people have forgotten about that assassination already, just as they've forgotten about everything that Israel's done against the Palestinian people, all the dirty details, the 15-year-old girl gunned down while she was on the phone begging for help, the 6-year-old girl calling in for paramedics to rescue her because her parents are dead, her sister's dead. She's hungry and thirsty, but the Israelis killed the paramedics, leaving the 6-year-old girl to die alone in a car. This happens every hour of every day. You know, so you know the international community has turned a blind eye to what the Israelis have done, not just in the West Bank but in Gaza, and Israel will be condemned by this.
Taking into account the military operation of Israelis in Gaza and the decision of International Criminal Court and the situation of Biden in the United States, considering the upcoming election 2024, which is he's losing the voters because of the conflict in Gaza, are we getting to the point that we're going to have some sort of ceasefire in Gaza?
Well, I think we're getting to that point. We're not there yet because Benjamin Netanyahu remains in power. I think there's widespread agreement that if there's a ceasefire, then that's the end of Benjamin Netanyahu politically. And so the question isn't about, you know, a ceasefire. The question is about Benjamin Netanyahu. When will he go? Under what conditions? Because that's the solution.
How do you see the picture of Middle East changing during the conflict in Ukraine and right now the conflict in Gaza?
I think Washington would like to keep the Ukrainian conflict and the Palestinian conflict separate and not allow things to get mixed. But overall, what we're looking at is are two situations where the United States is not successfully able to leverage its economic and military power, its diplomatic influence into victory. You know, Russia is winning and will win in Ukraine. There's nothing the United States can do to stop that. And not just Hamas is defeating Israel, but the axis of resistance, the Iranian-led partnership with Hezbollah, with Syria, with Iraq, with Yemen, you know, is emerging as one of the, you know, as the major power in the region. Hamas has defeated Israel. Israel no longer has this aura of invincibility. And the United States has to deal with that. We, have initiated bombing actions against the Houthi to deter the Houthi from shutting down the Bab el-Mandeb Straits to no effect. The Houthi shrug it off. They don't care. We've bombed Syrian and Iraqi militias, pro-Iranian militias. But in doing so, we violated sovereignty in Iraq to the extent that the Iraqi people are today demonstrating, hundreds of thousands surrounding the American embassy in Baghdad, demanding that the Americans leave. We are in a very weak position. Plan A is not working, and there is no plan B. So I think what we're going to watch unfold before us in real time is the strategic defeat of the United States in Europe and in the Middle East.
When you look at Biden and his position right now, he's much hurting from the war in Ukraine or the conflict in Gaza.
I think the of the two foreign policy questions, it's the situation in Gaza that's hurting him the most. He is a man who has been bought and paid for by the Israeli lobbies. And yet he's in a situation that if he pursues policy that will be supported by the Israeli lobbies, he will probably lose critical voters in critical states. It's already almost a certainty that the Arab American community in Michigan will not support Joe Biden. And Michigan is one of the states that he has to win if he is going to stay in power. And we're going to see a cascading effect like that about the situation in Gaza, especially if the United States continues to endorse ongoing Israeli genocide. On the issue of Ukraine, I think the mainstream media has become accustomed to the reality that Ukraine is going to lose this war, and they're publishing stories which are conditioning the American public to accept the inevitability of this outcome. So I don't think it matters going forward what's happening in Ukraine unless President Biden seeks to put his presidency on the line and insist that the Congress pass this $60+ billion loan package. If he commits to this in a very aggressive manner, he may get the money, but then he'll lose even worse because the fact of the matter is, right now, Ukraine not having the money provides a very convenient excuse for those who are trying to, get their head around the fact that Ukraine is getting whipped on the battlefront. Say, oh, America didn't provide the money. America abandoned them, et cetera. Well, in America, we don't care. We don't care what the world thinks. If we did, we wouldn't have left Afghanistan. So we're not worried about the consequences of Ukraine being defeated. What we're worried about is the consequences of sending money to Ukraine while there's an unresolved border dispute. Where Americans will start to say, why are you funding other nations' security but ignoring our own? And I think that's the direction that this debate will be heading.
If Trump wins, what does it mean for Ukraine and for Gaza?
Well, remember, to say if Trump wins, you're talking about a November election and a January inauguration, January 2025. There won't be a Ukraine then. It won't exist, so it doesn't matter. Trump is not a factor here in this conflict, nor is a factor in the Gaza conflict, because that conflict will be over there. Benjamin Netanyahu can't hold on for very much longer. He's in a very precarious situation, and he's going to have to yield the prime ministership to a successor who can look for a solution. And so, Trump's irrelevant, I think. When he becomes president, these two issues will have been resolved. He'll have to deal with the aftermath, with the consequences of these. And there, I think we know that Trump is very pro-Israel. So I think, it would be interesting to see how Trump deals with a two-state solution. But, Benjamin Netanyahu won't be in power by that time. Whoever's in power maybe will have taken a more moderate position on two states. So we'll see. On Ukraine, Trump has made it clear that, he doesn't support the, bottomless pit that NATO wants to be in when it comes to U.S. taxpayer dollars. That, he doesn't see the need to create a NATO capable of confronting Russia militarily. Trump will be faced with a fait accompli regarding Ukraine, meaning the defeat of the Ukrainian military, political establishment, and the end of Ukraine as we know it. So I think he'll be more focused on NATO, and he's already said that NATO is an outdated alliance, and maybe the United States shouldn't be continuing its participation in it. So I think that would be the greatest outcome, that Trump will weigh in. He'll be pro-Israeli, he'll be anti-NATO, but the Gaza conflict will be over and the Ukraine conflict will be over as well. So I think Trump is just isn't part of this current discussion.
Is Trump's presidency a threat, an existential threat for NATO?
I think NATO's an existential threat to NATO. It doesn't matter who the president of the United States is. Trump has certain inclinations that are anti-NATO in nature, but remember, he's also schizophrenic on this issue. On the one hand, he speaks of NATO not pulling its weight. On the other hand, he brags about how he got NATO to invest more militarily. So, it's not like we know which direction Trump is going to go when it comes to NATO.